9. The honor of dying. With a heavy pack strapped across her back, what she wouldn't have given for a simple transporter disc, Tiubo led a team of 4 out of the compound. Normally, they wouldn't have left X-Gal 4, for the sturdy station could handle almost any weather Belkaden could throw at it. Danny's call had made it clear that this storm was exceptional, though, and one needing some investigation. Also, though none of the 4 spoke of it openly, having a mission now helped them get through their grief over the accidental death of Garth Bryce. They had all known the risks when they had come out here, of course, into a wild and unexplored land, but still, losing one of the team had hit many of them hard, especially Tiubo. She knew that Benson Tomry would be devastated by the news if they could find some way to relay it to the now-distant spacecaster. The Twi'lek kept her blaster holstered, but the other 3 did not. They moved with weapons out and ready. With Luther Diono, a rugged man in his mid-20s, with coal-black hair and dark eyes, diligently guarding the left flank. Bandodi Ballo Reese, the oldest member of X-Gal 4 at 53, but a former barnstormer search-and-destroy agent with the Rebel Alliance, guarding the right. And Jerem Cadmir, a Corellian, watching the rear, practically walking backward as the group eased through the thick jungle. Jerem was obviously the least comfortable with his weapon. Not a warrior, the slender, gentle Jerem had been chosen to go out into the dangerous Belkaden jungle because he was the most knowledgeable member of the team with regard to geology and climatology. If the brewing storm Danny Kui had called back to warn about would truly pose a danger to X-Gal 4, Jerem Cadmir would be the one to give the most accurate early warning. "The most dangerous part will be the nights," Bandodi remarked late that afternoon. The team was making painfully slow progress through the tangles. "Red-crested cougars are night hunters, and they'll be thick about us, wanting to put a face to our strange scents." The others looked at Bandodi, at his ruggedly handsome face crossed by several scars he had earned in brutal combat, and found it hard to ignore the warning. "We can use the flight packs once we clear the jungle," Tiubo offered. "Then press on," Jerem urged nervously. "It's still going to be 2 days of walking," Bandodi told them. Tiubo eyed him unappreciatively. They had already fought out this debate back at the compound. Bandodi and Luther had wanted to strap on a couple of flight packs and fly off from the compound wall, despite the unarguable calculations that showed they'd fast deplete their fuel in trying to leap over the towering trees, and might have to spend a week of walking after they had left the primary canopy behind. Tiubo's plan, the sensible one, the one everyone at the station except for the 2 would-be warriors had agreed upon, called for traversing the jungle on foot, then strapping on the packs at the lip of the Great Basin, about 20 kilometers south of the compound. Given the angle and the calculated winds, they could cross the 300 kilometers of the basin for roughly the same amount of fuel that would have been used flying over the trees to the lip of the basin. With such logic on her side, Tiubo had won the debate, but she had known from the first grumbling steps out of the compound that Luther, and particularly Bandodi, weren't about to let the matter rest. So they pressed on, hot and sweaty in the steamy air, and as night descended, they found a thick nook high in a tree to call a campsite. They got little sleep, for the jungle resounded with threatening sounds, low growls and hisses, that seemed to come from right beside them. Despite the threat, though, they found no open challenge. But so disturbing were those sounds that the team set off early, determined to make the basin lip before the next nightfall. And they did, arriving at the rocky precipice on the edge of the jungle, overlooking the huge valley with hours to spare. Hours they would not waste. They quickly did some last-minute checks on the flight packs. Like every other piece of terrain equipment at X-Gal 4, the packs weren't in the best condition, and then lifted away from the precipice, opening wings wide to catch the gusting wind at their backs. They flew on right through twilight and into the darkness, preferring the cold winds to the sounds emanating from the trees far below. There were no great flying predators on Belkaden, as far as they knew. Tiubo measured their progress by the hour, not the kilometer. Given the minimum fuel burn gliding with the wind, she figured they could go for about 4 standard hours before exhausting the first half of their fuel. When the time came to land, Ben Doty fired a portable rocket flare into the canopy below, and the group used its guiding light to put down. They landed without incident, despite some very real and well-grounded fears propagated by the tumult of roars and shrieks in the region. A quick check of their positioning system confirmed that they had nearly crossed the length of the basin. If Danny's positioning had been correct, they should be able to find this brewing storm within a couple of days' march. Hopefully, they'd be able to get the needed measurements, mostly concerning wind speed, set their instruments, and be out of there quickly. Heartened, they settled in for a short night's rest. It was shorter than expected. Tiubo opened her eyes to the sound of coughing, a thick, mucus-filled hack. At first, she thought a thick ground fog had come up, but as the stench hit her, a noxious, rotten egg smell, she realized that it was something else. By the time the Twi'lek managed to sit up, she too was hacking and spitting. "Go to Enviro Suits," she heard Ben Doty cry. Hardly able to see, her eyes teary and stinging, Tiubo fumbled with her pack, finally pulling out the small hood and tank. "Gloves, too," Ben Doty barked to all of them, his voice muffled by his Enviro Suit. "No skin exposed until we know what this is." A few moments later, her eyes still burning, the sickening stench still in her mouth, but with clean oxygen flowing, Tiubo inched along the limb tangle they had chosen for a campsite to join Ben Doty and Luther. Jerem Cadmere had moved off along one branch with a light and seemed to be studying the leaves. "Probably a volcano," Luther remarked. "That's what Danny saw from orbit, a volcano spewing fumes. We'll have to call back to Exgal and have them lock the compound down tight." Ben Doty and Tiubo nodded, not overly concerned. The compound could be made completely self-sustaining, able to hold back whatever fumes Belkaden could throw at them. Several of the other Exgal stations with the same equipment as this one had been situated on worlds far more hostile, one on a spinning lump of barren rock that was completely bereft of any atmosphere. If the cloud was indeed volcano-formed, that would be good news, for likely there would be few, if any, potentially damaging winds. "It's not a volcano," came Jerem's voice, and the three turned to regard him sitting on a branch and holding a leaf. "It's the tree," he explained. That brought surprised expressions, and they moved over one at a time at Jerem's instructions and lifted their hoods just long enough to take a sniff of the leaf he held. "Let's get down from here," Luther remarked. "No," Ben Doty unexpectedly replied, even as the other three began to move for the main trunk. They looked to him questioningly. "I can't think of a safer place to be," the scarred old warrior remarked. "We'll stay up here in our suits, and where no cougars will want to go." The logic seemed sound. In the Enviro suits, the fumes couldn't hurt them. "How long to sunrise?" Luther asked. Tiubo checked her chronometer. 2 more hours. "Then sit tight," Ben Doty said. And they did, and when the sun came up, exploding brilliantly over the eastern horizon, they grew even more alarmed. For all the forest about them seemed to be on fire, sending greenish-orange smoke up into the air, and all the green leaves had turned yellow. It wasn't fire, they soon understood, but emissions, coming straight from the leaves, filling all the air with the noxious fumes. "How is this possible?" Tiubo asked, and she, Ben Doty, and Luther all looked to Jerem for an answer. The man stood holding a leaf, staring at it wide-eyed and shaking his head. "A molecular change?" he mused. "Luther, get up high while the rest of us go down to the ground," Ben Doty instructed, and he led the way out of the tree. The air was just as thick and wretched at ground level, for the grasses, even the moss and flowers, were similarly emitting the thick fumes. Jerem quickly went to one small plant and dug it up, roots and all, and as he did, some curious beetles, reddish-brown, scampered out of the hole. On Jerem's order, Tiubo caught one of them and held it up. "What is it?" Ben Doty asked. "Maybe nothing," Jerem replied. or maybe a clue. Before Bandoli could press him further, Luther came scrambling down the tree so quickly that he tumbled to the ground in a heap and nearly fell over again as he tried to rise. "It's going way past us," he explained, waving his arm back toward the north. "And it's rolling on. I could see the trees changing color and starting to smoke." "Let's get out of here," Tiubo suggested, and she popped the beetle into a belt pouch and pulled the lever control for her flight pack forward. Hardly waiting, she fired up the pack. Or tried to. It sputtered and coughed, even popped off enough once to jolt Tiubo into the air, a short hop and nothing more. Then it went dead. "It can't get enough oxygen," Bandoli reasoned. Even as he spoke, they heard a rustle to the side. They all tensed. Luther and Bandoli reached for their blasters as a red-crested cougar broke through the brush. They didn't have to shoot, they soon realized, for the great animal was gasping, its sides heaving in and out futilely. And if it even saw them, it showed no reaction. Right before their eyes, the creature staggered a few more steps and then fell to the ground, breathing its last. "Let's get out of here," Tiubo suggested, staring at the poignant reminder. She started to take off her pack, but Bandoli stopped her. "Keep it," he instructed. "We'll need them if we can get ahead of the..." He paused and looked at the others curiously. "Of whatever the hell this is," he finished. Jerem Cadmir pulled out his comlink and tried to call out, but the static that crackled back at him was too thick for any words to penetrate. Off they went as fast as their feet would carry them. After an hour, and half their oxygen, they still could not see the end of the noxious fumes before them. Bandoli sent Luther up yet another tree, while he and the others took out their comlinks and spread out, trying to find some hole in the static. Nothing. They rejoined at the base of the tree, and a dejected Luther came back down shaking his head, explaining that he couldn't see anything through the thickening gases. Hopelessness descended upon them, as thick as the fumes. To everyone's surprise, Bandoli Balorys pulled off his oxygen pack and tossed it to Jerem Cadmir. "Run on," he ordered. He sniffled, then crinkled his nose in disgust. "Run on. One of us has to get back and warn them." Jerem stood dumbfounded, as did Luther and Tiubo. "Go," Bandoli insisted. And even as Jerem started to argue, the older man turned and sprinted into the brush, disappearing from sight, though the others heard his subsequent hacking coughs. "He's gone crazy," Luther cried, and he rushed to follow. He barely got to the edge of the brush, though, before a blaster rang out, and Luther tumbled backward, shot through the chest. "Go," Bandoli called from somewhere beyond. Tiubo and Jerem rushed to Luther, but too late. The man was quite dead. Tiubo took his oxygen pack, grabbed the stunned and seemingly frozen Jerem by the arm, and hauled him after her, breaking into a dead run to the north. And then they heard another shot and knew that Bandoli, too, was dead. After another hour, no end to the biological disaster in sight, Jerem had to change tanks. He motioned for Tiubo to check her level as well. The Twi'lek didn't move. "Do you need oxygen?" Jerem asked her. Tiubo tossed him her extra tank. "Run," she explained. "I've been slowing you down for the last hour. You're the only hope." Then she took off her belt pouch, the one with the beetle, and tossed it to the stunned man as well. "I'm not leaving you," Jerem declared, and there seemed no room for debate in his voice. The extra tank in hand, he started for the Twi'lek, but stopped fast as Tiubo's blaster came up, leveled at him. "One of us has to continue with the remaining tanks," she explained. "You're faster, and you're better trained to figure out what's going on, so I made you the offer." Already from the gasps she took between her words, it was evident that her oxygen was waning. "Last chance," she said, waving the blaster toward the north. "Both of us," Jerem insisted. Tiubo pulled off her hood and threw it far to the side. Then, to Jerem's absolute horror, she took a deep breath of the noxious fumes about them. Immediately, her eyes turned reddish-yellow, and foamy liquid began running from her nose. "You're wasting time," she said, coughing with each word. "And oxygen." Jerem started for her, but her blaster came up and she fired a bolt right past his head. He ran to the north, blinded by the horrid fog and his own tears. He had gone only a dozen strides when he heard the report of a blaster behind him. On Jerem ran, desperately. He took some hope when he noted that the fumes about him were thinning somewhat, but at about the same time he had to switch to the last oxygen pack. Soon after that, he came to a sheer wall, only about 10 meters high, but one that he could not climb. Nor could he afford the time searching for a way around it. On the very edge of desperation, Jerem pulled forward the controls of his flight pack. Before he fired it up, though, he hit upon an idea. He pulled off his oxygen pack, tore the tube right from the side of his hood, and stuffed it into the intake valve of his flight pack. He fired it up. It sputtered and coughed, but sure enough, he got into the air and up over the cliff, where he found the air even clearer, as if the stony barrier had somehow slowed the plague. But he took little hope when he climbed higher into the air and looked back, for there, in its full yellow-green glory, was the storm Danny had called about. Not a storm at all, but a huge cloud of noxious fumes, a cloud growing by the second, fanning out in all directions. Flying on, Jerem glanced back several times to watch its progress. He figured it was spreading at about 10 kilometers an hour. X-Gal 4 had less than 2 days before it hit. Jerem pushed the flight pack full out and came out of the basin later that same day. He didn't land in the jungle and trudge through, but took his chances in the air, climbing above the treetops and soaring on. He did come down, and hard, when his pack ran out of fuel. He crashed through the branches and tumbled to the thick vegetation, losing his blaster in the process. He was alone in the jungle with no weapon and with night falling. He ran on. It loomed before them as soon as they came out of hyperspace, the fourth planet of the Helska system, a gray ball of ice several thousand kilometers in diameter. No mist surrounded the planet, no clouds, no notable atmosphere. To the eye, it appeared quite dead. Of course, Danny Quee and the other two knew better than to trust simple appearances. Many systems boasted of living watery worlds beneath the seemingly dead facade of empty ice. Still, the surface of the planet, on this side at least, appeared perfectly smooth, with no sign of any recent catastrophic impact. "Maybe it missed," Benson Tomry remarked. "We travel halfway across the sector in this rattle-and-shake contraption, and maybe it missed?" Cho Badelig sounded thoroughly disgusted. Danny eyed Benson hard, her look pointedly explaining that she didn't appreciate the man's sarcasm. "I'm serious," Benson retorted. "If the comet we saw hit that ball of ice, then why is it still here? It should have been blasted into a million pieces, with all of it hanging about in a floating maelstrom." Danny looked back at the viewer. Benson's words were true enough, she realized, and yet they knew from their observations on X-Gal 4 that the incoming comet had indeed hit this planet. "I am getting some strange signals from it," Cho Badelig offered, working the controls of his sensors. He looked up at the other two, their expressions hopeful. "Energy." "That could just be the reflection of the sun," Benson pointed out. Cho Badelig shook his head. "No, it's different." "How?" Danny asked, moving beside him. "Different spectrum than I'd expect from reflected sunlight," the man explained, and he shifted aside so that Danny could get a look at his indicators. They showed nothing consistent, more of a pulsating emanation, but indeed in wavelengths she would not expect from a frozen ball of water. "Organic?" she asked, and Cho only shrugged. "Maybe the comet was just a ball of gas," Benson Tomry reasoned. "That would explain a lot." "How do you figure?" Danny asked. "Well, the planet would still be here as it is," Benson remarked, "and a combination of gases could give us almost any reading." "But how did it stay together, crossing gravity fields?" Cho asked. "All right, almost a ball of gas," Danny put in, seeing Benson's reasoning. "A small, solid mass at the center." "With enough gravity to hold together a ball of gases that large?" Cho asked doubtfully. "Spinning super fast?" Danny asked more than stated, her voice thick with excitement. They all caught on fast enough, and their eyes lit up. "Call it in," Danny told Benson. I haven't been able to reach them, the man replied. The tower must still be down. Danny considered that for a long while.
Broadcast it generally, then, she said. We're going to need help with this.
Benson looked at her hard. By the time anyone gets out here, we'll already have the primary investigation done, Danny explained. It's our find now, no matter if the entire New Republic fleet comes swarming. You keep an eye on the readings, she told Chobadelig, and I'll bring us around to the other side. Benson smiled at that notion and opened his communicator to all channels, issuing a broadcast concerning their position and potential findings.
What was that?
Danny asked a few moments later when the spacecaster slipped around the side of the planet and a swarm of small meteors moved just ahead of them and out of sight around the far side.
I've got them too, Cho confirmed, his expression curious.
Hundreds.
What?
Benson asked. Danny throttled up.
Debris? She asked, and looked back at her companions, her face beaming. I think we've got something here.
Debris put into orbit from an impact, Chobadelig remarked, nodding. Again, just ahead of them around the curving line of the planet, they spotted the meteor swarm, but it was fast lost in the suddenly blinding sunlight as they came out of the planet's shadow. Danny squinted and groaned.
I've still got them, Cho assured her, up ahead and moving fast.
He paused and crinkled his brow.
Faster,
he clarified, and that, of course, made no sense.
And something else, Cho continued, down to the left, on the surface.
Following Cho's directions, Danny wheeled the not-so-agile spacecaster about, angling the screen to show them again the surface of the planet, flat, except for one large mound, somewhat covered by a thin icy layer, but obviously something other than ice. It seemed to be a milky substance, covering a mound of rough-edged, many-colored stone or bone.
There's the source of the readings,
Chobadelig said excitedly.
Danny brought them in slowly. Shouldn't we be going after those meteors first?
An obviously uncomfortable Benson Tomry remarked, and his sudden sense of dread wasn't lost on the other two.
If it's a creature, it's still alive, Chobadelig warned, staring at his sensors, not quite knowing what to make of the signals emanating from the mound.
Let's go catch the meteors, Benson remarked more firmly.
Danny looked to him and then to Cho and saw both mesmerized, one by the mound, one by his instruments. Then she looked back at the planet and above the line of the planet.
Oh, no, she muttered.
Let's go catch the meteors, Benson said again.
The meteors caught us, Danny explained,
and when the men looked up, they understood. In soared the meteors, but they couldn't be meteors, given the formation, a classic attack wedge.
Get us out of here, Benson screamed.
Danny worked furiously, bending the spacecaster to the side and down.
Setting for the jump to light speed, Danny called.
That'll take too long, Benson cried,
and his point was accentuated when the spacecaster jolted from some impact.
Just fire it, Chobadelig agreed.
Danny angled up, looking for a clear vector where she could just launch into hyperspace and take their chances with colliding with some other body millions of kilometers away. But the screen was full of the meteor ships, buzzing about like starfighters. One drew very close, and the three looked on in surprise and fear as a small appendage sticking out its front, like a miniature volcano, erupted, spewing forth a burst of fire and a single glob of molten rock that hit the spacecaster, jolting them hard.
"It's melting through," Benson Tomry cried.
"Engage the hyperdrive, Danny," Cho pleaded.
"I did," she replied, her voice calm, almost subdued. She had engaged the hyperdrive engine to no effect. She figured that the first jolts had been hits to that very drive, as if these attacking things knew exactly where to shoot. All three of the scientists jumped back reflexively as a glob of something hit their view shield. They looked on in helpless horror as it seemed to melt, or morph, right through the transparent shield, hanging like a ball of glue inside the window.
It pulsed and opened a single hole in its membranous form, and the two men cried out, and Danny dived for the weapons locker. And then the ball inverted, seemed almost to swallow itself, and what came out of it, or rather what it now appeared to be, was a humanoid head, disfigured and frightening and fully tattooed.
"Good you have come, Danny Quee, Benson Tomri, and Cho Bedelig," the ball said.
Or not the ball itself, Danny realized, recognizing this thing, this creature, as some sort of a communicator, and not the speaker himself. She didn't recognize his accent at all, and he seemed to be stuttering over every word.
"I, Dagara,"
he went on, "prefect and advisor to Yamask, war coordinator oof, Preterite Vong. Welcome my home." The three, too stunned by this Dagara creature's recognition of them, of its knowledge of their names, couldn't begin to respond.
"You see my home, I believe, Dagara went on politely. "You come me there, I show you splendor, Yuuzhan Vong."
"What?" Benson Tomri asked, looking to Danny.
"An invitation, I guess,"
Danny replied with a shrug.
"The Sea Villip," Prefect Dagara explained. "Pet of Yuuzhan Vong."
The three deciphered his words enough to understand that he was speaking of the creature that had invaded their spacecaster.
"To talk across long," Dagara went on.
"Living communicator," Cho Bedelig remarked, his scientist instincts somewhat overruling his fear.
"Where are you from?" Danny managed to ask.
"Place you know."
"Why have you come?"
Dagara answered with a laugh.
"Get us out of here," Benson Tomri pleaded with Danny.
She looked at him, then snarled and turned back to her controls, determined to fly her way through. But the meteors, the rock-like starfighters, were all about the spacecaster, spewing molten globs at exact points to continually cripple the ship. Before Danny could begin to initiate any evasive maneuvers, they were down to one drive, and that at a minimal capacity. Every other compartment in the craft had been breached, and the enviro unit had taken several hits. Danny straightened and looked helplessly at her companions.
"Choice none," the villip of Prefect Dagara remarked. "You follow coral skippers in, now, or you melt, and we take from you honor of gift to Yun Yamka."
"Just run," Cho Bedelig pleaded, trembling so violently that he stuttered through the two words.
"Choice none," Prefect Dagara warned.
Danny, full of frustration and anger, her scientific dreams shattered by some alien nightmare, tore open the weapons locker, pulled out a blaster, and splattered the villip all over the viewscreen. She scrambled to her feet, diving for the controls. And then they got hit again and again, and soon they were spinning, tumbling, out of control, and the planet seemed to rush up to swallow them. And then, nothing. Darkness fell, and still Jerem Cadmir ran on, stumbling in the blackness, and with exhaustion and fright, horrified with what he had seen and terrified of those dangers lurking all about him. The roars of the red-crested cougars traveled with him that night, and at one point he thought he saw one of the great animals eyeing him casually from a branch high above. Whether imagination or reality, Jerem would never know, for he had just run on, for all his life, for all the lives of those at the compound. Aside from his locating device, he had only three things with him, the beetle, the plant, and a sample of the noxious fumes he had fortunately and unintentionally trapped within one of his sample bags. He took little comfort when night turned back to day, for he could hardly think straight at that point. He thought he was traveling in the right direction and in line, but his locating device was showing some signs of damage, probably from the fumes, and he couldn't be sure.
"Wonderful for all of us if I run right past the compound," he lamented.
He thought he recognized one tangled tree, but in truth they all looked alike. How relieved he was then, when he scrambled headlong over a thicket, cutting 100 small scratches on his arm, and found another member of the ex-gal team waiting for him.
"The compound?"
Jerem gasped. "Right over there," Yeoman Carr answered, moving to help Jerem back to his feet.
"Where are your companions?"
"Dead," Jerem said, puffing for breath.
"All of them."
Yeoman Carr pulled him up straight and stared at him hard.
We found the storm, but it wasn't a storm,"
Jerem tried to explain. "Some kind of plague, a biological disaster. It overran us."
"But you escaped," Yeoman Carr said.
"They gave me their oxygen," the man replied, and he began to tremble. Yeoman Carr shook him hard.
"One of us had to get back," Jerem went on, "to warn the rest of you. We have to fire up the Jolian freighter and get out of here."
"The Jolian freighter?" Yeoman Carr echoed with a laugh. "That ship hasn't been up since the compound was first set up, and half of its components were scavenged for the station operating systems. We will never launch it."
"We have to,"
Jerem cried, grabbing Yeoman Carr by the shoulders. "No choice."
"A plague, you say?"
Yeoman Carr asked, and Jerem nodded excitedly. "Well, perhaps we will find a way to battle back against it, or insulate ourselves from its effects."
"We can insulate,"
Jerem said, and he started past Yeoman Carr, but to his surprise, the bigger man held him in place.
"But once it's upon us, we'll have no way to call out,"
Jerem tried to explain, and he tried to pull away.
"The fumes."
"Fumes?" Yeoman Carr asked calmly.
"No time to explain," Jerem said. "We have to get out of here."
Yeoman Carr yanked Jerem about and slammed him hard into a tree. Jerem, held there motionless, stared at the larger and suddenly imposing man in sheer disbelief.
"I could let you go to them," Yeoman Carr said. "I could scramble into the compound beside you, yelling frantically that we must get the Jolian freighter up into the air."
"You don't understand," Jerem said. "The plague advances at a tremendous rate. It will be here in a matter of hours."
"Within 3, to be more precise,"
Yeoman Carr remarked. Jerem started to respond, but then the weighty implications of Yeoman Carr's last statement hit him fully and stole the words from his mouth.
"The gases will overwhelm the compound within 3 hours,"
Yeoman Carr stated,
"and all the planet in 2 days, sooner if favorable weather allows the atmospheric levels to hit critical mass."
"Favorable weather?" Jerem Cadmere echoed with confusion. "How do you know?" Yeoman Carr reached a finger up beside his nose and tapped the sensitive area of the Ooglith masker, signaling the creature to peel away. Jerem Cadmere tried to retreat, tried to push himself right into the tree at his back when the masker flaps receded and he saw the disfigured, tattooed face of Yeoman Carr. The Yuuzhan Vong warrior stood perfectly still, reveling in the exquisite tingles of agony as the masker pulled away fully and slipped down beneath his loose-fitting clothing.
"I could take you back there and wait with you and the others for your doom to fall,"
Yeoman Carr explained.
"For, of course, I've disabled the freighter beyond repair. Not that you would have been able to get the rusted thing off the ground in any case. I could let you battle valiantly against the transformation, which you call a plague, and let you die dishonorably at no warrior's hands, but simply from lack of oxygen."
Jerem was shaking his head, his lips moving as if he was trying to respond, though no words came out.
"But I feel that I owe you this, out of respect for your perseverance and resourcefulness in getting all the way back here,"
Yeoman Carr went on. Jerem exploded into movement, rushing off to the side, but Yeoman Carr, his muscles toned by years of warrior training, caught him easily, one hand clamping under Jerem's chin, the other grabbing the hair at the back of the man's head. With frightening ease, Yeoman Carr pushed Jerem low and tilted his head back so that he was looking up into that horrid, disfigured face.
"Do you understand the honor I offer you now?"
Yeoman Carr asked in all seriousness. Jerem didn't respond.
"I offer you a warrior's death," the Yuuzhan Vong cried. Unyamka.
He gave a sudden twist of his arms and shattered Jerem Cadmir's neck bone. Yomankar let the limp man fall to the ground. He stood solemnly over Jerem for a long, long while, uttering prayer after prayer for the slayer to accept this sacrifice. By Yomankar's reckoning, he had indeed granted Jerem Cadmir a tremendous amount of respect this day. He even went somewhat against orders by not allowing the scientists to battle the plague unimpeded. But Yomankar could justify that. Jerem had seen too much of the plague and knew, and said as much, that they could not hope to battle it. Jerem would have prompted only a desperate flight attempt and no real countering of the plague. The Yuuzhan Vong warrior nodded, agreeing with that reasoning, and reached down to inspect Jerem's body, finding the three valuable items. He'd bring them back for inspection, allow the remaining six scientists to try to find some solution. That would satisfy his duties regarding the plague, for one of his goals here was to discern if the scientists could find some way to battle this powerful Yuuzhan Vong biological weapon. Completing that duty would justify his showing respect to Jerem Cadmir. Satisfied, the Yuuzhan Vong started back for the compound. All his rationales were in place, but he knew the truth in his heart. He had killed Jerem Cadmir, not simply out of respect, not simply because the man had deserved a warrior's death, but also because he had wanted to, because he had enjoyed it. For too long, Yomankar had lived among the infidels, had spoken their language, and accepted their strange and sacrilegious actions. Now the day of glory was almost upon him, the day of the Yuuzhan Vong, and he was eager, so eager. At first Danny thought she was dead, but as her consciousness gradually returned, before she even opened her eyes, she not only knew that she was very much alive, though painfully wounded, but also sensed somehow where she was. And that thought, that she was within the living mound she had seen from the spacecaster's view screen, filled her with dread. Her right shoulder, dislocated, throbbed. Both of her arms were held out straight. She could feel strong hands gripping her wrists, and the light touch of a poncho about her bare shoulders, and a wet stickiness about her feet, as if she was standing in a gooey pool of mud. She heard a gurgled cry, recognized the voice of Benson Tomry, and forced open her eyes. She saw the multicolored, rough-face walls, the hulking men. No, not men, she instinctively understood, but some other humanoids, disfigured and covered with tattoos, holding her arms out to either side, out straight, and so tightly that she could not move. She saw Benson off to the side, standing, but with his head pulled back, another hulking humanoid beside him. That tattooed warrior lifted one hand up high, clawed it like a bird's talon, and drove it down into Benson's throat. The warriors let go, and Benson fell limp, too limp, and Danny knew that he was dead. The hulking warrior, his hands still wet with Benson's blood, came over toward her slowly, deliberately. Danny tried to struggle, but the two humanoids holding her gave sudden jerks, and waves of pain overwhelmed her, rolling out from her dislocated shoulder as the joint snapped back into place. She nearly swooned and rolled her head, and then he was before her and she saw him clearly, and she recognized him from the impersonating creature that had invaded the spacecaster.
Yomankar demand respect for Danny Kui, Prefect Dagara stated. Do you under...
He paused and crinkled his face, struggling for the word.
Understand, the woman said through clenched teeth.
Dagara nodded and smiled.
You understand the honor?
Danny looked at him helplessly. Then she felt the tingling pain, and the goo at her feet came alive and began to roll up her naked legs. Danny's eyes widened with horror and pain as the creature began its attachment, rolling higher and higher to cover all of her body beneath the poncho. She struggled and flailed. Dagara slapped her across the face.
Do not dishonor Yomankar request, he growled in her face. Show courage, or I put you out to die in empty air of surface.
That sobered Danny. She still squirmed. Who could not, as the creature attached itself, tendril by tendril, into her pores? but she bit down on her lip and stood firm, eyeing Degara sternly. The prefect nodded his approval. Glad I that Danny not dead, as was Chobadelig when we bring you down, Degara said. I expect to kill you myself, and now, but honorably, this day. Danny didn't blink. Reconsidered, Degara explained. Perhaps it better you stand with me to see Jidorji. He shook his head, recognizing that he was using the Yuuzhan Vong word. To see glory of Preterite Vong. Danny shook her head, unable to comprehend what this was all about. You like see galaxy die? Degara asked bluntly. That made long ago, for you see us enter worldship, the begin of end. Danny crinkled her face. She was getting the gist of Degara's meaning, and the thought seemed absurd. Yes, the prefect said, and he brought his hand in and gently stroked Danny's cheek, which repulsed her more than if he had clenched his fist and punched her. You see with me, and you see truth. Vajilor, the glory of Yuuzhan Vong. Might you come to see and believe, and you join. Might you hold Vicky. Anger in pride, and you die. No matter. In thinking, I make Yun Yamka more happy. Danny wanted to ask what or who Yun Yamka might be, but she just shook her head, too overwhelmed by it all. Degara turned away from the stunned woman and motioned to another warrior, who approached Danny holding a soft lump of star-shaped flesh. She recoiled instinctively, tried to fight with every ounce of her strength. But they were too strong, and the cry of her protest was muffled as the fleshy creature was put over her mouth. Her horror only intensified as its tendrils snaked down her throat, gagging her at first, but then joining with her, becoming a part of her breathing system. Eyes wide with shock and pain, Danny was hauled through the chambers of the world ship to a large room with a circular hole in the floor. The actual opening was larger than that, Danny understood, seeing the ice all about that hole, and she couldn't understand why she wasn't colder, why they weren't all freezing. That thought flew away, though, in an instant of sheer terror, when Degara walked up behind her and unceremoniously shoved her headlong into the hole, and she fell down a long tubular worm to the watery depths below. The prefect jumped in after her.